Harper Audio presents A Scot in the Dark, Scandal and Scoundrel, Book 2, by Sarah McLean, performed by Justine Eyre. Scandal and Scoundrel, Volume 2, Issue 1, Sunday, 9 May, 1834. Warnick's Wild Ward. We have it on excellent authority that the oddsmakers on St. James's are wagering that a certain duke has returned to London to remind his not-so-young ward that her gossip is not his gain. In the brisk spring air, the Duke of Warnick dons the mantle of matchmaker for Miss Lillian Hargrove, now known as Miss Muse, to those who have heard of, or better seen, the promiscuous painting that has scandalized society and summoned the Scottish scoundrel south. Excitement is expected with the arrival of the Highland devil and half-hearted duke. All that can be assured is that spring will bring more tartan to town. And ton. More to come. Prologue. Ducal devastation. 1 dozen days of darkness and demise. March 1829. Bernard Settlesworth, Esquire, believed that name was destiny. Indeed, as the third in a familial line of solicitors to the aristocracy, it was difficult not to believe such a thing. Bernard took immense pride in his work, which he performed with precision on nearly every day of the year. After all, he would tell himself, the British aristocracy was built on the hard work of men such as he. Without the Bernard Settlesworths of the world expertly calculating ledgers and deftly managing enormous estates, the House of Lords would crumble, leaving nothing but the dust of ancient lines and fortunes. He did the Lord's work, ensuring the aristocracy remained standing and solvent. And though he took pride in all aspects of his work, there was nothing Bernard enjoyed quite so much as meeting with new inheritors, for it was in those moments that the Settlesworth name was best put to work, settling Worth. Bernard enjoyed this part best, that is, until tragedy struck the dukedom of Warnick. 2 marquises, 6 different earls and baronets, a landed gentleman and his 3 sons, a vicar, a ship's captain, a hatter, a horse breeder, and 1 duke. Lost to a spate of tragedies that included, but was not limited to, a carriage accident, a hunting mishap, a robbery gone wrong, a drowning in the Thames, an unfortunate incident with influenza, and a truly unsettling incident with a cormorant. 17 dukes, if he were honest, Bernard supposed. All dead, all within the span of a fortnight. It was a turn of events, 17 turns of events, unheard of in British history. But Bernard was nothing if not dedicated. Even more so when it fell to him to play protector to such an old and venerable title, to its vast lands, made vaster by the rapid successive death of 17 men, several of whom died without issue, and large fortunes, made larger by the same. And so it was that he stood in the great stone entryway of Dunworthy Castle in the cold, windy wild of Scotland, face to face with Alec Stewart, once 17th in line for the Dukedom of Warnick, now the last known heir to the title. Face to face wasn't quite accurate. After being greeted by a pretty young woman, Bernard had been left to wait, surrounded by massive tapestries and a handful of ancient weaponry, which appeared to have been haphazardly affixed to the wall. And so he waited, and waited. After 3/4 of an hour, 2 large dogs appeared, bigger than any he'd ever seen, grey and wild. They approached, the movements deceptively lazy. Bernard pressed himself to the stone wall, hoping they would decide to find another, more appetizing victim. Instead, they sat at his feet, wire-haired heads reaching nearly to his chest, grinning up at him, no doubt thinking him quite tasty. Bernard did not care for it. Indeed, for the first time in his career, he considered the possibility that soliciting was a less than enjoyable profession. And then the man arrived, looking wilder than the dogs. He was dark-haired and big as a house. Bernard had never seen a man so big. Well past 6.5 feet, he imagined, with what might have been 20 stone on his broad, muscled frame, and none of it fat. Bernard could tell that bit because the man wasn't wearing a shirt. Indeed, he wasn't wearing trousers either. He was wearing a kilt and carrying a broadsword. For a moment, Bernard wondered if he'd travelled through time as well as space on the journey to Scotland. It was, after all, 1829, despite the Scotsman appearing as though he'd arrived via 3 centuries earlier. The enormous man ignored him, tossing the sword up onto the wall, where it stuck as though by sheer force of its owner's will. That same owner, who then turned his back on Bernard and made to leave. Bernard cleared his throat, the sound louder than he'd intended in the massive stone space, loud enough for the man to turn and cast a lingering look over the solicitor's diminutive in comparison frame. After a long silence, he said,
"Who are you?"
At least that's what Bernard thought he said. The words were thick on the man's tongue, wrapped in brogue.
I...
Bernard collected himself and willed the stutter away, despite being surrounded by beasts both human and canine.
"I am waiting for an audience with the master of the house," the man rumbled, and Bernard imagined the deep sound was amusement.
"Careful. These stones sound like hearing that you think they've a master."
Bernard blinked. He'd heard tales of mad Scots, but he hadn't expected to meet one. Perhaps he misunderstood in the confusion of rolling R's and missing syllables.
"I beg your pardon."
The man studied him for a long moment.
"Mine are the capes. For..."
Bernard wasn't sure what to say. He wasn't apologising to the castle, was he? He tilted his head.
"Is Mr. Stuart here?"
The enormous man rocked back on his heels, and Bernard had the distinct impression that his obvious discomfort was pleasing to the great brute, as though he shouldn't be the one who was uncomfortable, what with traipsing around the castle half-nude.
I've been waiting nearly an hour for him."
The dog sensed his irritation and stood, clearly offended by it. Bernard swallowed.
"Angus, Hardy."
Instantly, they retreated to their master's side. And it was then that Bernard knew. He looked to the half-naked man across the entryway and said,
"You are he."
"Aye, but we still have nae established who you are."
"Alec!"
A young woman's voice echoed through the castle.
"There's a man here. Says he's a solicitor from London."
The new Duke of Warwick didn't look away from Bernard as he raised his voice in reply.
"He also says he's been waiting for me for an hour."
"Seems nothing good could come of a fancy London solicitor," the voice sang down. "Why bother you while you were having a spar?"
"Why indeed," the Scot replied. "Apologies. My sister doesn't care for the English."
Bernard nodded.
"Is there a place we might speak more privately?"
"As I care even less for the English than my sister does," the Duke said. "We needn't stand on ceremony. You're welcome to state your purpose here and now, and then you may leave."
Bernard imagined the man's view of England would change quite a bit once he discovered he'd become a peer of the realm, an exceedingly wealthy one.
"Of course, it's my very great pleasure to tell you that, as of 12 days ago, you are the Duke of Warwick."
Throughout his career, Bernard had witnessed all manner of response to the reality of inheritance. He'd stood by in the face of devastation of those who had lost beloved fathers, and recognized the eagerness on the face of those with not-so-beloved sires. He'd witnessed the shock of distant inheritors, and the joy of those whose fortunes had changed in the blink of an eye. And on the least pleasurable of his days, he'd witnessed the devastating burden of inheritance, when a newly minted aristocrat discovered that his title had come with nothing but incapacitating debt. But in the more than 20 years that he had served the upper echelons of the aristocracy, Bernard had never once met with apathy. Until now, when the Scotsman he'd crossed a country to find calmly said,
"Nay,"
turned on his heel and made for the exit, dogs on his heels. Settlesworth sputtered his confusion.
Your Grace?
A long bout of laughter came at the honorific.
"I have no interest in an English title, and I certainly have no interest in being anyone's Grace."
With that, the 21st Duke of Warwick, last of a venerable line and rich as a king, disappeared. Bernard waited another hour in the stone keep, and a full 3 days at the only inn in the nearby town, but the Duke had no interest in speaking with him again. And so it was that for the next 5 years the Duke rarely showed face in London, and when he did, he eschewed all things aristocratic. Within months, London society had discerned his disdain, and decided that it was they, in fact, who disdained him, and not the other way around. The diluted Duke, they contended, was worth neither time nor energy. After all, 17th in line for a dukedom was virtually no duke at all. Such a view suited Alec Stewart, proud Scotsman, more than well, and he resumed his life without a second thought for the trappings of his title. As he was no monster, he managed his now vast estates with meticulous care, ensuring that those who relied upon Warwick lands were well and prosperous. But he avoided London, believing that as long as England ignored him, he could ignore England. And England did ignore him, right up until it didn't. Right up until a missive arrived, revealing that alongside the estates and servants and paintings and carpets he had inherited, alongside the title he had no interest in using, the Duke of Warwick had inherited something else entirely. A woman. Chapter 1. Lovely Lily Turned Miss Muse. April 1834. Royal Academy Exhibition. Somerset House, London. Miss Lillian Hargrove was the most beautiful woman in England. It was an empirical fact, requiring absolutely no confirmation from experts on the subject. One had only to set eyes upon her, noting her porcelain skin, precisely symmetrical features, high cheekbones, full lips, curving ears, and a pretty straight nose that evoked the very best of classical sculpture, and one simply knew. Add to it her red hair, somehow not at all brash but a rich golden hue that evoked the most heavenly of sunsets, and her grey eyes like a summer storm, and there was no question at all. Lillian Hargrove was perfect, so perfect that the fact she'd come from nothing, that she lacked title, social standing and dowry, that she'd been plucked from Lord Knew Where by London's finest artist to whom she was not married. was somehow rendered irrelevant when she entered a room. After all, nothing blinded gentlemen, titled or otherwise, quite like beauty, a fact that was enough to set any matchmaking mamma with an invitation to Almack's on edge. Which was why the female half of the aristocracy took exceeding pleasure in the events of the 24th of April, 1834, the opening day of the Royal Academy Exhibition of Contemporary Art, and the day Lillian Hargrove, current favoured beauty of the scandal sheets, was made a proper scandal. And ruined. Thoroughly. Later, when that same subsection of the ton whispered fervently about the events of the day, white gloves hiding fingertips stained black with ink from the gossip rags they swore they never read, the conversation would always end with a horrified, gleeful, "The poor thing never saw it coming." And she hadn't. Indeed, Lily had thought it would be the best day of her life. It was the day she'd been waiting for her entire life, all 23 years, 48 weeks. It was the day Derek Hawkins was to propose. Not that she'd known Derek for her entire life. She hadn't. She'd known him for 6 months, 3 weeks, and 5 days, since he'd approached her on the afternoon of Michaelmas as she lingered in the Hyde Park sun on one of the last warm days of the year, and told her, in no uncertain terms, that he was going to marry her. "You are a revelation," he'd said in his cool, crisp voice, surprising her from her book. Another might have considered his unexpected arrival the reason for her breathlessness, but Lily had known better. He had taken her breath away because he had found her, ignored in her place in the margins. Despite her beauty, she was alone and unnoticed by the world, thrice orphaned, first by her land steward father, then by a string of ducal guardians, each meeting a quick end, and finally, in full, by the neglect of the current duke. In her loneliness, she'd become very adept at being unseen. So when Derek Hawkins noticed her, when he saw her with the full, blinding force of his gaze, she'd fallen quite in love, quite instantly. Lily had done her best to seem unaffected by his words. After all, she'd not read every London ladies' magazine published in the last 5 years for nothing. Looking up at him, she tried her best, softest smile and said, "We have not met, sir." He'd crouch next to her at that, removing the book from her lap, charming her with his blinding white teeth and even more blinding impertinence.
"A beauty such as you should not have time for books."
She blinked, drawn to his cool blue eyes, trained upon her as though they were the only two people in all London, in all the world. "But I like books." He'd shaken his head.
"Not as much as you shall like me."
She'd laughed at the boast. "You seem very certain of yourself."
"I'm very certain of you," he'd said,
lifting her hand from her lap and pressing a warm kiss to her gloved knuckles.
"I am Derek Hawkins, and you are the muse for which I have been searching. I intend to keep you for all eternity."
She'd caught her breath at the vow, at the way it evoked other, more formal ones. Certainly, meeting Derek Hawkins was a shock. She'd been reading about him for years. He was a legend, an artist and star of the stage, renowned throughout London and beyond as one of the most skilled theatrical minds of a generation. News of his talent and good looks preceded him, and while Lily could not in the moment confirm the former, the latter appeared quite accurate. But it was not his celebrity that won Lily over. She had more than fluff between her ears, after all. She did not dream of a famous suitor. She dreamed of a suitor who would ensure she was never alone again. After all, Lily had been alone for her entire life. In the days and weeks that followed, Derek had courted her, playing the part of the perfect gentleman, escorting her to autumn festivals and winter events, even hiring an older female servant to chaperone them on public outings. And then, on a cold, snowy afternoon in January, he'd sent a carriage for her, and she'd been ferreted to his studio, the inner sanctum of his artist's world. Alone. There, in the sun-soaked room surrounded by dozens of canvases, he'd honoured her with his words and promises, worshipped her beauty and her perfection, and vowed to keep her with him forever. The words, so pretty and tempting and precisely what she'd always dreamed of hearing from a man so handsome and skilled and valued beyond measure, had filled her with more happiness and hope than she'd ever imagined possible. For 2 months and 5 days, she'd returned to the studio again and again, sitting with more than a little pride in the room, warm with winter sunlight and Derek's gaze. She'd given him everything he asked, because that was what one did when one was in love. And they were in love, a fact that was proven by this moment as they stood in the great hall of the Royal Exhibition, surrounded by the brightest and most renowned of London's populace. Lily was a half-step behind Derek's right shoulder, where he preferred her, wearing a pale yellow frock, slightly lower than Lily would have liked, but which he'd selected himself, her hair up in a tight, unyielding twist, precisely the way he liked. As they'd ridden to the exhibition, the rain forcing them inside his carriage, where it tapped its rhythm on the roof and shut out the world beyond, he'd taken her hand in his and whispered, "Today is the day that changes everything, for all time. After today, all will be different. My name will be whispered throughout the world, and yours as well." She'd blinked up at him, heart bursting, knowing that he could mean only one thing, marriage. She'd smiled and whispered back, "Together." The carriage had slowed in that moment, and they'd arrived at the exhibition, but she'd heard his agreement in the thunder of the rainstorm beyond. Together. And now they were here, and she was feeling prouder than she'd ever been in her life, for this man who would soon be her husband, and for herself as well. After all, it was not every day that the orphaned daughter of a land steward was so privileged to stand before all of London with the man she loved. The room was massive, the walls reaching 20 feet high and every inch of them covered in artwork. Every inch, that was, but one central spot behind a dais on the far end of the space, this one covered instead with a curtain of sorts, as though what was there was due a magnificent reveal. Derek turned back to give her a wink. "That one's for us." Lily smiled. Us. What a lovely, lovely word. How long had she wished to be a part of an us? "Mr. Hawkins," the secretary of the academy met them at the midpoint of the room with a firm handshake and a fervent whisper in Derek's ear. "Thank goodness you've arrived. We are ready for the announcement immediately, if you are, sir." Derek nodded, his lips curving into a wide smile that marked his triumph. "I'm always ready for announcements such as this." Lily looked about the room, taking in the crush of people, all waiting for the exhibition to begin. She recognised a handful of London's brightest and was immediately unnerved by the idea that she was surrounded by titles and funds. She stiffened, suddenly wishing that Derek had proposed yesterday so she might be allowed to reach for him, to steady herself in the force of London's combined gaze. "He's brought that Hargrove girl with him." Lily resisted the urge to turn at the sound of her name, whispered, but too loud not to be heard. She assumed that had been the speaker's plan all along. "Of course he has," came the scathing reply. "He delights in dotage. And look at the way she stares after him, like a pup after a bone." The first speaker tuttered her distaste. "As if it weren't enough that she looks the way she does." Lily willed herself not to listen and fixed her eyes on the back of Derek's head, where his black hair curled in perfect whirls. They did not matter. Only Derek mattered. Only their future. Together. Us. "Everyone knows anyone who looks the way she does is a complete scandal. I cannot believe he'd bring her here. Today of all days, there are dukes in attendance. I heard the Queen might appear. If that is true, it's even more disgusting that he would bring her. His own consort." The words came on a chortle, as though they were clever. They weren't. Lily resisted the suggestion that she might be something other than Derek's betrothed, as though she were a scandal. And even though she wasn't, even though there was nothing scandalous about love, her cheeks flamed and the room grew warmer. She turned to Derek, willing him to hear the women, to turn and tell them that not only were they speaking out of turn, but that they were speaking out of turn about his future wife. But he didn't hear. He was already moving away from her, bounding up the stairs to the place where the curtain hung, hiding his masterpiece. He hadn't let her see it, of course, hadn't wanted to tempt fate. But she knew his skill, and knew that whatever he had selected for the exhibition would take London by storm. He'd told her as much only minutes earlier. and when it did take London by storm, the women behind her would eat their words. Derek had reached the center of the dais, made a show of peeking behind the curtain before turning toward the assembled crowd as Sir Martin Archer Shee, the president of the Royal Academy, welcomed London to the exhibition. The speech was impressive, delivered in the distinguished man's booming Irish brogue, noting the venerable history of the Academy and its exhibitions. Indeed, the art on the walls was very good indeed. It was not the quality of Derek's, of course, but it was fine art. There were several very nice landscapes. And then it was time.
Each year, the Academy prides itself on a special piece, a first exhibition from one of Britain's most skilled contemporary artists. In the past, we've revealed unparalleled works from Thomas Gainsborough and Joseph Turner and John Constable, each to more acclaim than the last. This year, we are most proud to showcase renowned artist of stage and canvas, Derek Hawkins.
Derek's chest puffed with pride.
It is my masterwork.
Sir Martin turned toward the unexpected interjection.
Would you like to speak to it now?
Derek stepped forward.
I shall say more once it is revealed, but for now I shall offer only this. It is the greatest nude of our time.
He paused.
The greatest nude of all time.
A hush went over the room. Not that Lily could hear it over the loud rushing in her ears. Nude. To her knowledge, Derek had only ever painted one nude.
It bests Rubens, he'd said,
as she'd lain in repose on the cobalt settee in his studio, surrounded by satin pillows and lush fabrics.
It is more glorious than Titian.
The words were not a memory, however. He was speaking them again, now, casting his arrogant gaze across the crowd.
It makes Ingres look like he should return to school.
He turned to the president of the Academy.
The Royal Academy, of course.
The boast, an insult to one of the greatest artists of the day, unlocked the assembly, and the collective whispers rose in a cacophony, adding sound to the wild heat that consumed Lily.
Outrageous, someone said nearby.
He'd sworn it was for his eyes alone.
I've never heard such conceit.
He'd promised her no one would ever see it. The women behind her spoke again, snide and unpleasant.
Of course. That's why he brought her.
It couldn't be she. It couldn't be. No doubt, came the agreement. She's low enough to be the model.
Model is too kind. It implies value. She's too cheap for such a word. Only allowed inside the door because of the goodwill of...
She turned to stare at them, halting the words in the speaker's throat, the truth of the moment bringing unwanted tears to her eyes. They didn't care. The two women stared right at her, as though she were a roach in the gutter.
Her guardian clearly understands that beauty has no bearing on worth.
Lily turned away, the cruel words setting her in motion. At first, simply to escape the horrid women, and then to escape her own fear. And then to stop Derek from bearing her to the world. She pushed her way through the crowd, which was already crushing closer and closer to the stage and the painting, still hidden. Thankfully, Sir Martin had resumed speaking, but Lily did not hear the words, too focused on getting to the dais, on getting to the painting. She climbed the stairs, driven by something far more powerful than embarrassment. Shame. Shame for what she had done, for trusting him, for believing him. For believing she'd ever be more than herself, alone. For believing in the promise of us. And then she was on the stage, and he was turning toward her, the room going silent once more, in utter shock at her presence, at her intrusion. The president of the Academy turned wide eyes on her. Derek moved with perfect ease, however, waving one arm toward her.
Ah, my muse arrives.
It was time for Lily's eyes to go wide. He'd ruined her, as though she'd removed her clothes in front of all of London. And still he smiled at her, as though he didn't see it.
My lovely Lily, the conduit of my genius. Smile, darling.
She would never have imagined that the words would have made her so very furious. She didn't stop moving, and she did not smile.
You swore no one would see it.
The room gasped.
as though the walls themselves could draw breath. He blinked.
I did no such thing.
Liar. You said it was for you alone. He smiled as though it would explain everything.
Darling, my genius is too vast for me not to share it. It is for the world, for all time.
She looked to the crowd, to the hundreds of eyes assembled, the force of their combined gaze setting her back on her feet, making her knees weak, making her heart pound, making her furious. She turned back to him. You said you loved me. He tilted his head.
Did I?
She was out of space, of time, her body no longer hers, the moment no longer hers. She shook her head.
You did. You said it. We said it. We were to be married.
He laughed, laughed. The sound echoed in the gasps and whispers of the crowd beyond, but Lily didn't care. His laugh was enough to slay on its own.
Dear girl, he mocked. A man of my caliber does not marry a woman of yours.
He said it in front of all London, before these people whom she'd always dreamed of becoming, before this world in which she'd always dreamed of living, before this man whom she'd always dreamed of loving, but who had never loved her, who, instead, had shamed her. She turned to the curtain, her purpose singular. To destroy his masterwork the way he'd destroyed her, without care that those assembled would see the painting. She tore at the curtain, the thick red velour coming from its moorings with virtually no pressure, or perhaps with the strength of her fury, revealing bare wall. There was nothing there. She turned back to the room, surprised laughter and scandalized gasps and whispers as loud as cannon fire rioting through her. The painting wasn't there. Relief came, hot and overpowering. She whirled to face the man she'd loved, the man who had betrayed her.
Where is it?
Teeth flashed, blinding white.
It is in a safe space, he replied,
his voice booming, placing them both on show as he turned back to the room.
Look at her, London. Witness her passion, her emotion, her beauty. And return here in 1 month's time on the final day of the exhibition to witness all that into something more beautiful, more passionate. I shall set grown men to weeping with my work, as though they have seen the face of God.
A collective gasp of delight thundered through the room. They thought it a play, her a performer. They did not realize her life was ruined, her heart crushed beneath his perfectly shined boot. They did not realize she was cleaved in two before them. Or perhaps they did. And perhaps it was the realization that gave them such glee. Chapter 2. Scott Summoned South by Wild Ward. 2 weeks and 4 days later, Berkeley Square. A ward. Worse, an English ward. One would think Settlesworth would have told him about that bit. One would think that among the dozens of homes and scores of vehicles and hundreds of staff and thousands of tenants and tens of thousands of livestock,
Settlesworth would have thought it valuable to mention the existence of a single young female. A young female who, despite her utter lack of propriety on paper, would no doubt swoon when she came face to face with her Scottish guardian. English women were consummate swooners. In 34 years, he'd never met one who didn't widely, loudly, and ridiculously threaten the behaviour. But Settlesworth hadn't mentioned the girl, not even in passing, with a, "By the way, there's a ward, and a significantly troublesome one at that." At least he hadn't mentioned it until she'd been so troublesome as to require Alec's presence in London. And then it was, "Your Grace, this and scandal, that, and you must come as quickly as possible to repair her reputation," in conclusion. So much for Settlesworth being the best solicitor in history. If Alec had any interest in aiding the peerage, he'd take out an advertisement in the News of London to alert them to the man's complete ineptitude. A ward seemed the kind of thing a man should know about from the start of his guardianship, rather than the moment the damn woman did something supremely stupid and ended up in desperate need of rescue. If he had any sense, he'd have ignored the summons. But apparently he lacked sense, all told, and Alec Stewart, proud Scotsman and unwilling 21st Duke of Warwick, was here, on the steps of No. 45 Berkeley Square, waiting for someone to answer the damn door. He considered his watch for the third time in as many minutes before he set to knocking once more, letting all his irritation fall against the great slab of mahogany. When he completed the action, he turned his back to the door and surveyed the square, perfectly manicured, gated, and just blooming green, designed for the residents of this impeccable part of London, and no one else. The place was so damn British, it made his skin crawl. Curse his sister.
"A word!" Catherine had crowed when she'd heard. "How exciting! Do you think she is very glamorous and beautiful?"
When he'd told Catherine that, in his experience, beauty was the reason for most scandals, and he wasn't interested in dealing with this particular one, his sister had insisted he immediately pack his bags, playing him like a fine fiddle, the baggage.
"But what if she's been greatly maligned? What if she's all alone? What if she requires a friend? Or a champion?"
She'd paused, blinking her enormous blue eyes up at him, and added,
"What if I were in her place?"
Younger sisters were clearly a punishment for ill deeds in former lives, and current ones. He crossed his arms over his chest, the wool of his jacket pulling tight across his shoulders, constricting him just as the architecture did, all ironwork and stone facade. He hated it here. "England will be your ruin." Next door, a gaggle of women exited No. 44 Berkeley Square, making their way down the steps to a waiting carriage. A young lady saw him, her eyes going wide before she recoiled in shock and snapped her gaze away to hiss a whisper at the rest of the group, which instantly turned in unison to gawk at him. He felt their stares like a blazing heat, made hotter when the oldest of the group, mother or aunt, if he had to guess, said loudly,
"Of course she would have such a man waiting for an audience. He looks veritably animalistic."
Alec went instantly cold as the group tittered its amusement. Ignoring the wash of fury that came over him at the assessment, he returned his attention to the door. Where in hell were the servants?
"She's probably renting rooms in there," one of the girls said. "And other things as well," came a snide reply. "She's outrageous enough for it."
What on earth kind of scandal had the girl gotten herself into? Settleworth's letter had been perfunctory in the extreme, apologising for not apprising him of the existence of the ward, and laying the girl at Alec's feet. "She is at the heart of a scandal, a quite unsurvivable one if you do not arrive. Post haste." He might hate all things English, but Alec wasn't a monster. He wasn't about to leave the girl to the damn wolves. And if the she-wolves next door were any indication, it was a good thing he was here, as the poor girl was already their meal. He knew what it was to be at the hands of English women. Resisting the urge to tell the women they could pile into their carriage and drive straight to hell, he raised his fist to pound once more. The door opened in an instant, and after impressively recovering from his shock, Alec glowered down at the woman standing before him, wearing the drabbest grey dress he'd ever seen. He imagined she was no more than 25, with high cheekbones and porcelain skin and full lips and red hair that somehow gleamed like gold, despite the fact that she was inside a dimly lit foyer. It was as though the woman travelled with her own son. Drab frock or no, it was not beyond hyperbole to say she was easily the most beautiful woman in Britain. Of course she was. Nothing made a bad day worse like a beautiful English woman.
"It's about bloody time," he growled.
It took the maid several seconds to recover from her own shock and lift her eyes from where they had focused at his chest up to his face, her eyebrows rising with every inch of her gaze. Alec was transfixed. Her eyes were grey, not slate and not steel, but the colour of the darkest rain clouds shot through with silver. He stiffened, the too small coat pulling tight across his shoulders, reminding him that he was in England and whoever this woman was, she was irrelevant to his interests, with the exception of the fact that she was standing between him and his immediate return to Scotland.
"I suggest you let me in, lass."
One red brow rose. "I shall do no such thing." She closed the door. Alec blinked, surprise and disbelief warring for a fleeting moment before they were both overcome by a supreme loss of patience. He stepped back, sized up the door, and with a heave, broke the thing down. It crashed to the foyer floor with a mighty thud. He could not resist turning to the women next door, now frozen in collective, wide-eyed shock.
"Animal enough for you, ladies."
The question spurred them into action, sending them fairly climbing over each other to enter their carriage. Satisfied, Alec returned his attention to his own house and, ignoring the pain in his shoulder, crossed the threshold. The maid stood just inside, staring down at the great oak slab.
"You could have killed me."
"Doubtful," he said. "The door is nae heavy enough to kill a person."
Her gaze narrowed on him. "Number 18, I presume." The words could not have held more disdain. Ignoring them, Alec lifted the door from its resting place and turned to lean it against the open doorway. He deliberately thickened his accent.
"Then you ken who I am."
"I'm not certain there's a person in London who wouldn't easily ken you, though you might learn the word no if you wish them to understand you." He raised a brow at her smart mouth.
"I don't care for being left waiting at the door of my own home."
Her gaze moved pointedly to the door, removed from its hinges. "You make a habit of destroying things when they displease you?" Alec resisted the urge to deny the words. He had spent the majority of his adult life proving that he was not coarse, not rough, not a brute. But he would not defend himself to this woman.
"I pay handsomely for the privilege."
She rolled her eyes. "Charming." He refused to reveal his shock. While he had little to no experience with aristocratic servants, he was fairly certain that they did not make a habit of sniping at their masters. Nevertheless, he did not rise to the bait, instead taking in the impeccable home with its broad, sweeping center staircase, stunning and massive oil landscapes on the walls, a touch of gilt here and there, indicating modernity rather than garishness. He turned in a slow circle, considering the high ceilings, the massive mirrors that captured and reflected light from the windows high above, casting the whole space in natural light and offering a glimpse of a wide, colourful carpet and a roaring fireplace through a nearby open door. It was the kind of house that should belong to a duke with impressive pedigree, no doubt decorated by some previous duchess. He stilled. Was there a previous duchess? With 17 dead dukes, Alec would bet there was more than one previous duchess. He growled at the thought. All he needed was a widow to deal with, on top of the scandalous ward and the petulant staff. The staff in question heard the sound of displeasure. "I know they called you the diluted duke, but I did not think you would be so..." The impertinence trailed off, but Alec heard the unspoken words. Beastly, coarse, unrefined. He lost his patience.
"I suggest you fetch Lady Lillian, immediately."
"It's Miss Hargrove. She's not highborn." He raised a brow.
"This is England, is it not? Have they changed the rules, then? You gleefully correct dukes now."
I do, and the Duke in question is wrong, she said. Though you should be fine, as few will understand enough of your monstrous accent to know if you are right or wrong.
You seem to understand me well enough.
She smiled too sweetly. My vast good fortune, I suppose. He resisted the urge to laugh at the quick retort. The woman was not amusing. She was moments from being sacked.
And what of the respect that comes with the title?
It comes from people who are impressed by said title, I imagine.
And you are not?
She crossed her arms. Not particularly.
May I ask why?
There have been 18 of you in 5 years, or to be more precise, 17 in 2 weeks, followed by you for 5 years. And despite this being the first time you've set foot in this house, it and all its contents belong to you, are cared for you, in absentia. If that's not evidence that titles are ridiculous, I'm not sure what is. She wasn't saying anything he didn't believe, but that did not mean she was not maddening, likely just as mad as the other woman in the house.
While your insubordination is impressive, and I do not entirely disagree with your logic, I've had enough, he said. I intend to speak with Miss Lillian, and your task, whether you like it or not, is to fetch her.
Why are you here? He let stony silence stretch between them for a long minute, attempting to intimidate her into doing as he asked.
Fetch your mistress.
She was not intimidated in the slightest. I think it amusing that you refer to her as mistress of the house, as though she isn't a prisoner of it. That's when he knew. His ward was not the swooning type, after all. Before he could speak, however, she continued. As though she were not a belonging, just like the door you summarily destroyed like a great Scottish brute. He didn't mean to hear the word, but somehow, standing here with this impeccable English woman in this impeccable English townhouse in this impeccable English square, wearing an uncomfortable suit barely fitting in the open doorway, feeling big and out of place, he couldn't help but hear it. Couldn't help but feel it, close and unsettling, like the tight cravat around his neck. How often had he heard it from beautiful women? Whispered in awe, as though they were too busy imagining the fine, deep knot she would make in their bedposts to keep their innermost thoughts to themselves. When one came in the size he did, women tended to desire it like a prize, a bull at the county fair, massive and beastly. The word honoured their desire, even as it demeaned his own, just as it had demeaned him on his mother's lips, marking her regret as she'd spat it at him. Always too large to be fine enough for her, too big to be worthy of her, too coarse, too Scottish, too much a reminder of her disappointing life. She'd loathe his size, his strength, his inheritance from his father, loathed it so much that she'd left that single word her parting gift to her only son. Brute. And so, when he heard it here, in this place, on the lips of another beautiful Englishwoman, with such thorough disdain, he was unable to avoid it, just as he was unable to resist retaliating.
I had hoped you wouldn't be beautiful.
She narrowed her gaze. The descriptor does not seem a compliment on your lips. A vision flashed, this stunning woman laid across a bed, hair spread like fire and gold across white linen, long limbs beckoning, pink lips parted. Desire shot through him like pain, and he forced himself to remember his place. He was her guardian, she was his ward, and English at that. She was not for him.
It's not, he said. It makes it far more likely you did it.
Her eyes were glorious, more expressive than he would ever have imagined, and filled instantly with challenge. Did what?
Ruined yourself.
The anger changed to something else, gone so quickly that he might not have recognized it if it were not so unbearably familiar to him. Shame. And in her shame, in the way it bore the shadow of his own, he instantly regretted his words, and he wished them gone.
I should not have.
Why not? It is true. He watched her for a long moment, taking in her straight spine, her square shoulders, her high head. The strength she should not have, but carried like honour, nonetheless.
We should begin again, he said.
I would prefer we not begin at all, she said, and turned away from him, leaving him in the hallway, with nothing to keep his company but the sounds from the square beyond floating through the permanently open doorway. She needed the diluted Duke like she needed a hole in the head. She closed the door to the sitting room off the foyer, pressing her back to it and releasing a long breath, willing him gone from the house, gone from her life. After all, it was not as though he'd taken an interest in her for the last 5 years. But, of course, he was here now, literally banging down the door of her home, as though he could barge in like an avenging guardian king, as though he had ownership over her and her scandal. Which, of course, he did. Damn Suttlesworth and his copious letter writing. And damn the Duke for turning up uninvited, unwanted. Lily had a plan, and it did not require the Duke. She should not have incited him. She should not have insulted him. Indeed, one did not catch flies with vinegar, and the Duke was a rather fat fly. She crossed the room to the sideboard on the far end. Not fat, poured herself a glass of the amber liquid there. He was all strength. Lily did not think she would forget the image of the great oak door bursting from its hinges as though made of paper, and she did not think she would ever not lose her breath at the vision of the enormous man, big as a house and handsome beyond measure, standing in the wake of his destruction, framed by sunlight as though the heavens themselves had sent him down. She stopped. What utter rubbish! Being housebound for the past 2 weeks and 4 days, hiding from the rest of London, she must have been addled by the onset of fresh air that had arrived when the man had beat the door down. That alone was enough to set any woman on edge, particularly one who had been fooled by handsome men before. Lily had no interest in his broad shoulders, or his brown eyes, or his full lips that seemed at once soft and firm and terribly tempting. And she hadn't even noticed the cheeks and nose and jaw, strong enough to have been hewn in iron by the most talented Scottish blacksmiths. She sipped at the whiskey in her glass. No, the only interest she had in the Duke of Warwick was in getting him gone.
Lillian!
She whirled around to find the object of her lack of interest in the now open doorway. His brown gaze fell to the glass in her hand.
It's 10:30 in the morning.
She drank again, purposefully. If ever there were a time for drink, it was now. I see you are aware of how doors properly function. He raised a brow and watched her for a long moment before saying,
If we are imbibing, I'll have one as well.
She gave him her back as she poured a second glass, and when she turned to deliver it to him, it was to find that he'd already crossed the room without sound. She resisted the urge to move away from him. He was too large, too commanding, too compelling. He took the glass.
Thank you.
She nodded. It's your drink. You're welcome to it. He did not drink. Instead, he moved away to the fireplace, where he inspected a large classical oil painting of a nude man, sleeping under a willow tree beneath the gaze of a beautiful woman, dawn crawling across the sky. Lily gritted her teeth as she, too, considered the painting, a nude, unsettling in its reminder of.
Shall we discuss the scandal?
No. Her cheeks burned. She didn't like it. Is there a scandal? He turned to look at her.
You tell me.
Well, I imagine the news that you broke down the door in broad daylight will get around. Something flashed in his eyes. Something like amusement. She didn't like that, either.
Is it true, Lass?
And in that moment, in the 4 simple words, spoken in his rolling Scottish brogue, warm and rough and almost kinder than she could bear, she wished herself anywhere but there. Because it was the first time anyone had asked the question, and it was the millionth time that she'd wished the answer were different. I think you should go. He was still for a long moment, and then he said,
I'm here to help.
She laughed at that, the sound without humour. It is impressive, Your Grace, how well you sound the caring guardian.
I came as soon as I heard of your predicament.
She was a legend, evidently.
It reached you all the way in Scotland, did it?
In my experience, rumour travels like lightning.
And you've much experience with rumours?
More than I would care to admit.
Lily heard the truth in the words. And were your rumours true? He was silent, long enough for her to think he might not reply, so it was a particular shock when he said simply,
Yes.
She'd never in her life been so curious about a single word. Of course, it was nonsense. Whatever his scandal, it was not like this. It had not destroyed him. It had not forced him to flee. She met his gaze. And now what? You arrive to tend your reputation?
I don't care a fig for my reputation. I'm here to tend yours.
This was a lie. No one had ever cared for Lily's reputation, not since her father had died. She'd never had a patroness, never a friend, never a love. The thought came with hot tears, stinging with the threat of their appearance, unwelcome and infuriating. She inhaled sharply and turned back to the sideboard, refusing to reveal them to him. Why? His brow furrowed.
Why?
You don't even know me. He hesitated, then.
You are my responsibility.
She laughed. She couldn't help looking back. You've never once taken interest in me. You did not even know I existed, did you? She saw the guilt in his eyes, the truth there. I suppose that is better than the alternative.
Which is?
That you've known about me for years and simply ignored my existence. He would not have been the only one.
Had I known?
He trailed off. What? You would have returned to London years ago, immediately taken up the banner of guardian and saviour. He shifted on his massive feet, and she felt a twinge of regret, knowing that he did not deserve her accusations. She bit her tongue, refusing to apologise, wishing he would leave, wishing he had never come. If wishes were horses.
I am not a monster, he answered finally. I did not ask for the responsibility, but I would have made certain you were provided for, without hesitation.
'Twas always thus, a promise of funds, of room and board, a promise of all the bits that came easily, and a dearth of everything that had value. She waved her hand to indicate the beautiful house. I am perfectly provided for. Look at the beautiful cage in which I perch. She did not wait for him to reply. It is no matter either way. I'm afraid you are rather too late. She pushed past him, saying, I'm in the market for neither guardian nor saviour. Indeed, if the last few years have taught me anything, it is that I would do well to save myself. Play my own guardian. He did not reply until she reached the door to the sitting room.
You're older than I expected.
She stopped, looked back. I beg your pardon. He did not move.
How old are you?
She matched the impertinent question. How old are you?
I am old enough to know that you're older than any ward should be.
If only you hadn't had such a long-standing disinterest in your guardianship, you might know the answer to your question.
Do not take it personally.
Your long-standing disinterest?
Now that I know you exist, I find myself quite interested.
I suppose you would be, now that I'm a creature under glass to watch and point to as a warning to all others. He raised a black brow and crossed his arms over his massive chest.
Seconds ago, you were a bird in a cage.
Is it the mixed metaphors you are interested in? She retorted. He did not hesitate.
No, it's you.
The words warmed her, not that they should have. A pity that, as I am not interested in you.
You should be. As I understand it, guardians have quite a bit of control over wards.
I'm a ward of the Warnock estate. I would not get too possessive if I were you.
Am I not Warnock?
Perhaps not for long. You dukes do have a habit of dying.
I suppose you'd like that.
A woman can dream. His lips twitched at the words, and if she were to tell the truth, she would have admitted that she enjoyed the fact that she'd amused him. She was not interested in the truth, however.
Well, I am not dead yet, Lillian, so you are landed with me for the time being. You'd do best to answer my questions.
He paused, then repeated himself.
You're rather old for a ward, eh?
Of course she was. She'd been lost in the fray. Her father had died and left her in the care of the Duke, and all had been well for several years until the Duke had died, and 16 more as well. And then this man, this legendary Scot who had eschewed all things English and never even turned up in Parliament to receive his letters of patent, had been in charge. And Lily had been forgotten. No dowry, no season, no friends. She looked to him, wishing there were a way to tell him all of that, to make him understand his part in the mad play of her life, without rewatching the play herself. As there wasn't, she settled upon. I am, rather. She sat in a pretty little Chippendale chair, watching him as he watched her, as he tried to understand her, as though if he looked long enough, she would unlock herself. The irony was, if he'd done the same a year earlier, she might have unlocked herself. She might have opened to him and answered all his questions, laid herself bare to him. Her lips twisted in a sad smile at the thought. Laid herself bare in all ways, likely. Thankfully, he was a year too late, and she was a lifetime different. I am ward of the estate until such time as I marry.
Why haven't you married?
She blinked. Many would find that inquiry inappropriate. He raised a brow and indicated the door to the house.
Do I seem a man who cares for propriety?
He did not. There were a dozen reasons why she was unmarried, reasons that had to do with being orphaned and ignored and alone, and then desperately smitten with the wrong man. But she was not going to share them, so she settled on a simpler, no less honest truth. I have never been asked.
That seems impossible.
Why?
Because men are a halfpenny a dozen when it comes to women like you.
Women like her. She stiffened. This man made her beauty sound as it felt. Have a care. Your flattery will spoil me, Your Grace. He sat then, folding himself a matching chair, his enormous frame making it seem minuscule.
Alec.
I beg your pardon?
You may call me Alec.
While that may be done in the wilds of Scotland, Your Grace, it is thoroughly inappropriate here.
Again with the invocation of propriety, he said. Fine, call me Stuart then, or any number of the other invectives you no doubt been thinking, he said. I'll take them all before a duke.
But you are a duke.
Not by choice.
He drank